and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the role of a whistleblower at the Environmental Protection Agency, Miguel Del Torrell, who first revealed the toxic nature of the water in Flint, Michigan, only to be silenced and gagged for doing his job by the EPA's Region 5 Administrator, Susan Hedman, a political appointee. Investigative journalist Kurt Guyette, who heads the Michigan Democracy Watch program with the ACLU of Michigan, who previously worked in Detroit with the Metro Times as an investigative reporter, columnist, and news editor for 18 years, joins us for an update. He was the first to publish the EPA memo leaked by Miguel Del Torrell that first recognized the extraordinarily high levels of lead in Flint's drinking water and called for phosphate treatment for corrosion control by the MDEQ, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Inexplicably, Susan Hedman decided not to have the EPA compel the MDEQ to apply the $100 a day phosphate treatment to protect the Flint water infrastructure from leaching lead, but instead silenced Miguel Del Torrell. Then we'll look into the report issued today in the UK by Sir Robert Owen, the chairman of the public inquiry into the poisoning by radioactive polonium of the exiled Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko in London 10 years ago. First, Karen DeWisher, a professor of political science at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, joins us. She is the author of Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? And we will discuss the break between Litvinenko and his boss Putin, who was then the head of the successor agency to the KGB, the FSB, over the Russian intelligence service's complicity in the bombing of apartment buildings on the outskirts of Moscow in 1999 that were blamed on Chechen rebels and were used by Putin as an excuse to go to war and thus rise to power. Then we'll hear from an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, Matthew Rajansky. He is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, and we will discuss what diplomatic fallout might follow from the report that points a finger at Putin for probably approving the assassination. But since the Russian leader has now made himself indispensable to solving the war in Syria, it is likely that Putin will get away with what amounts to nuclear terrorism on the streets of London. And joining us now is Kurt Guyette, who's an investigative journalist who heads the Michigan Democracy Watch program with the ACLU of Michigan and previously worked in Detroit with the Metro Times as an investigative reporter, columnist, and news editor for 18 years. He was the first reporter to break the story about the nature of the water that was being consumed by the residents of Flint, Michigan. Kurt, it's really good to catch up with you again because this extra element in the story is now becoming, I wouldn't say it's being broken, but it's becoming, I think the public are becoming more and more aware of not just Governor Schneider's role, but now the EPA's role. And you were the first person to print the memo from the EPA whistleblower, Miguel Del Torrell. So let's start with that, how he contacted you and what was in the memo and why the EPA basically silenced Miguel Del Torrell.
Well, he didn't contact me. What happened was that one of the Flint residents, a mom whose child had been lead poisoned, was sort of relentless in trying to get to the root of the situation. And she searched and searched until she found Mr. Del Torrell, who was like the one bureaucrat who showed a heart in all of this. And he began working with the mom, her name is Leanne Walters, and to conduct an independent test of her home's water. Mr. Del Torrell hooked Ms. Walters up with Mark Edwards at Virginia Tech, and Dr. Edwards sent sample kits to Ms. Walters. They tested, took 30 samples from her home, so they could test everywhere along the line to see what the water was like. One of those tests showed levels of lead in the water above 13,000 parts per billion. Water is considered hazardous waste if it has 5,000 parts per billion lead. So it was more than 2.5 times what it takes to be classified as hazardous waste. So Mr. Del Torrell wrote a memo, an internal memo and laying out the science behind the problem, saying that the Flint River water was too corrosive. The Michigan Department of Environmental Quality was violating the law by not adding the required corrosion control chemicals. And then being a veteran of the EPA, was concerned that the memo was not going to go anywhere, that it would get watered down and papered over. And so to prevent that from happening, because he believed that there was a public health crisis underway in Flint at that point, which this is in June of 15, he gave a copy of that memo to Ms. Walters. Ms. Walters gave it to me. I contacted Mr. Del Toro, who spoke on the record to me, talking about the things that were in the memo, why he was doing what he was doing, why he thought it was not just important but critical to get the word out so the people of Flint would know about that, the likelihood of lead being in their water. We published the memo, wrote a story about it, and that was the last I was in communication with Mr. Del Toro. We know now that the EPA told people in the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality that Mr. Del Toro had been, quote, handled. The regional director of the EPA in Chicago apologized to the mayor of Flint for Mr. Del Toro's actions, and he was, Mark Edwards described it as Mr. Del Toro being put under house arrest and gagged, you know, because he did what any person with a conscience and strong moral fiber would do, which is to take actions to protect the public health and protect kids from being lead poisoned.
And again, I'm speaking with Kurt Guyette, who's an investigative journalist who heads the Michigan Democracy Watch program with the ACLU of Michigan and previously worked in Detroit with the Metro Times as an investigative reporter, columnist, and news editor for 18 years. He was the first reporter to break the story of the nature of the contamination of the water in Flint, Michigan. And we're talking about the important role of a EPA whistleblower, Miguel Del Toro, who was essentially quashed by the EPA Region 5 Administrator Susan Hedman. Now, I don't understand why anybody in a federal government agency that's charged with protecting the health of the American people and the environment would do what they did. And furthermore, she's a political appointee. So what's the Obama administration saying about her? They, on the one hand, you know, Obama's criticizing Governor Snyder, and there's an awful lot to criticize there. But how did this woman become appointed to the head of EPA's Region 5?
You know, honestly, I don't know what her qualifications for the job were. And, you know, to be honest with you, Ian, I haven't focused my attention on that aspect of this so far. I've been so far focused on looking at what's been going on at the city level, what city officials in Flint did, and what the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality did to basically cheat on their tests to make it appear that the water was safe when it wasn't. And so I've been, you know, familiar with the emails that we have obtained through the Freedom of Information Act request and the degree to which the EPA seems to have really kind of bent over backwards to give wiggle room to the MDEQ for essentially violating the law, but certainly it's been mystifying to me and very frustrating to me as a reporter trying to get to the truth here. The EPA, to say that they've been unhelpful throughout this whole process is an understatement.
But what's mystifying here is that Miguel Del Toro with the EPA, he first recognized the lead problems in the Flint water And on February the 26th, that was February the 26th of last year, and then the next day, Del Toro asked the MDEQ if Flint was using the phosphates for corrosion control. And then he then, in, apparently in this memo, and I believe it's the memo that you leaked, he simply sent it up to his boss, Susan Hedman, and others, saying that, basically saying that they should be using this, what, $100 a month or $100 a day or something?
$100 a day, yeah.
Phosphate treatment to protect the water. I mean, we're talking about a lot of money. And the whole idea was to save money. That's why Snyder and his, you know, cost-cutting guy that he had all the power, the emergency manager, they were supposed to be saving money. Well, if you're talking about $100 a day, that's nothing. And what? So that's right. The key, isn't it? Why would the government person, the EPA head, not want to insist that if there's lead in there, at least put in this stuff that cuts it down, which is this phosphate treatment?
Yeah. That's one of the mystifying things. I mean, how tight were they pinching pennies? That because they went from a water source that was very low in terms of its corrosivity, the Lake Huron that was supplied by the Detroit Water Department, and in addition to that, even though it was low corrosivity, Detroit was adding phosphates to the Flint River, which is at least five times more corrosive than the Lake Huron river water was. And so at a time when corrosion control is more needed than ever, they stop using it. There's a number of mind-boggling things here, but, you know, I think they just didn't care about Flint. You know, it was a city, majority African-American, poverty rate of 40%, certainly not many Republican votes there, but the callousness and disregard for the people of Flint is just astounding, absolutely astounding. But it makes no sense, because now what we're seeing is how short-sighted. First, the switch to the river, which, you know, saved. Their first estimate was it would save them $5 million. And now we're looking at the governor just got the legislature to do emergency, you know, send $28 million to Flint. The National Guard has been deployed, passing out water, and filters. And the mayor of Flint has estimated that the damage to the infrastructure might be $1.5 billion. So it is all just incredibly so short-sighted and misguided. And just the financial aspect of it, it's lunacy. You know, it's hard to even put into words how crazy it is.
Well, that's the problem I'm having, is I'm trying to get my head around the idea that the head of the Region 5 of the EPA, the top administrator, Susan Hedman, who's a political appointee of the Obama administration, why she would basically squelch the whistleblower, who, as you said, was a man with a conscience and a heart, who was first contacted by a resident of Flint, and he did the independent testing and found out that the lead levels were beyond belief, into the territory classified as toxic waste. And yet his boss basically silenced him. And then she appeared to be in collusion with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality to keep obfuscating and lying. And now the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are beating up on Snyder, who certainly deserves it. But, you know, I don't understand the politics of this. How could a person appointed by the Obama administration be working with the governor and with his people against the people of Flint and, in effect, against the position that the Democrats are now taking?
Yeah, it just, there's so much that makes no sense. I'm sorry I can't give you any answers, because it's just nonsensical. And maybe more is going to come out. I don't know. And, you know, maybe somebody from the EPA will explain to me the internal politics of what's going on. You know, maybe it's, I don't know if because the right wing has so demonized the EPA that they're afraid to do anything. You know, that could be it. But honestly, other than that, I don't have any answers. You know, they're afraid of having their funding cut by the, you know, hostile right that doesn't want anything done that they perceive as to be a harmful to business. But certainly, this just goes to prove, you know, which is they were running Flint like a business. All attention was on the bottom line. Well, this is what happens when you, you know, serve the interests of business above all else. You know, you get a disaster, and then you pay in the long run. You think you're saving in the short run, and it costs you orders of magnitude more in the long run for the stupid, short-sighted nature of that kind of thinking.
Well, the only thing I can figure out is that maybe this is a case of regulatory capture, that the EPA has been captured by the very people that they're supposed to be monitoring. We learned that from the blowout in the Gulf, that the oversight group that was responsible for safety on oil rigs were pretty much captured by the oil companies. Thus, there wasn't that blowout preventer that worked. So this could be the only explanation. So just in closing, what's your sense there on the ground, Kurt, about when something's going to be said? Because Dr. Mark Edwards is pretty much a hero, along with Miguel del Toral, and it seems like the press is now starting to notice them. Mm-hmm. So you'd think that this woman's going to get shamed, isn't she?
I don't know. Ian, I'm a reporter, not a predictor. All I can do is you know, lay out the facts and, you know, keep following the story. So I try to stay away from making predictions because, you know, you end up looking foolish a lot of the time. So all I can say is that we're going to keep reporting and you know, I'm not done filing FOIAs and looking for information. So, you know, we're moving ahead with our investigation.
Well, Kurt, I had to talk about serendipity. I've just learned that the EPA regional administrator for Flint, who we're talking about here, Susan Headman, has just submitted her resignation. The agency said an hour or so ago that EPA Region 5 Administrator Susan Headman has offered her resignation effective February the 1st, and EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy has accepted, given Susan's strong interest in ensuring that EPA Region 5's focus remains solely on the restoration of Flint's drinking water. So, pretty extraordinary turn of events here. Here we are scratching our heads wondering how this woman could possibly be in a position of being our advocate for clean water and the environment, and yet working against the people, not just of Flint, but of the United States. I take it it's just proved to be too much for her and for everybody else, probably for Gina McCarthy as well. So what do you make of that turn of events?
I'm sorry, I'm a little bit speechless, to tell you the truth. Things have been moving so quickly with this story, Ian. You know, it took so long for this story to get traction. You know, at times it felt like we were butting our heads against a brick wall, trying to get people to pay attention to this, really for a couple months after we reported that memo. And, you know, in the past month or so, but especially now recently, it's just moving with lightning speed. But certainly, the fact that this person who is responsible for protecting the public health failed to do her job, it's totally appropriate for her to have resigned as the way she did.
Well, I'm just looking here at the press release from the EPA talking about her resignation here. The statement from Gina McCarthy, the head of the EPA, apparently has encouraged her staff to elevate, quoting, critical public health issues in an agency-wide memo. And the memo includes specific parameters for staff to elevate critical public health and or environmental issues so that the agency can properly assess them and respond at appropriate policy and governmental levels. It seems to be an admission that, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, here at the EPA, we're supposed to be elevating critical public health issues. I mean, it's pretty pathetic that they have to remind their own employees of the of their essential mission.
And I think the other thing is that gets back to the original topic of our conversation, that it's no doubt vindication for Mr. Del Toro.
Well, that's a good note to end on, Kurt Guyette, and I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again,
thank you for continuing to follow this.
Oh, well, I think this is an amazing aspect of the story that needs more exposure. And again, I've been speaking with Kurt Guyette, who's an investigative journalist who heads the Michigan Democracy Watch program with the ACLU of Michigan. He previously worked in Detroit with the Metro Times as an investigative reporter, columnist, and news editor for 18 years. And he was the first reporter to break the story of the nature of the contamination of the water that citizens and residents of Flint, Michigan were forced to drink. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into a report issued today that points the finger at Vladimir Putin for approving the assassination of a Russian spy in London. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Karen DeWisher, who's a professor of political science in the Department of Political Science at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. She's the director of the university's Havengerst Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies, and her latest book is Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? Welcome to Background Briefing, Karen DeWisher.
Thanks very much.
And what do you make of the British inquiry that now come to the conclusion that Vladimir Putin may well have been the author of the poisoning and assassination of the former KGB agent in London, Litvinenko, who was poisoned by a cup of tea laced with polonium-210?
Well, I haven't had a very positive view of Vladimir Putin for some time, so I wasn't very surprised. I have to say that I prefer this outcome to an alternative outcome, which would have been that he was poisoned as a result of some rogue group that's operating from within the Russian security services, or poisoned by Russian mafia. So it does demonstrate that they believe that there was no collapse in the chain of command within the security services, and that, as with any other major country, whether it was Britain or the United States, if you're going to kill somebody abroad, it has to be approved by the commander-in-chief, which is the head of state.
Well, it certainly does look like the two KGB officers that have been charged with the actual assassination, those that met with Litvinenko in London and had tea with him, and of course it was apparently the green tea that he drank was laced with polonium, which can only be manufactured in fairly sophisticated nuclear reactors. It does seem that they're directly in the chain of command. Now, the other political assassinations that have taken place, particularly going back to Anna Politkovskaya and the more recent political opponent of Putin, who was assassinated right there in the shadow of the Kremlin, they've been attributed to this sort of rogue Chechen KGB that's run by the Chechen warlord who Putin installed. So that's kind of a cutout operation that he seems to have. So is that what goes on here, that he's got two? He can either authorize state security assassinations, in this case, where the chain comes back to him or the fingerprints come back to him, and then his alternative method seems to be via the Chechens.
Right. I think that what we got from the report is a very detailed, I mean, the report is 350 pages long. So we've got a very detailed scientific analysis of what it would take to weaponize polonium-210. Weaponized for ingestion as a poison. And this is not something that can be undertaken by a private or civilian agency. It, first of all, the polonium-210 is manufactured by the Russian Nuclear Atomic Energy Authority, Rosatom, and then it would have had to be transferred into a capsule form that could be carried safely by the two people who are now shown to have carried the polonium. And the authorization for transferring that polonium-210 from a military to a civilian authority where it could be weaponized with poison, that's a state function. I mean, that it would have taken the highest authority to approve that kind of assassination. So this isn't a situation in which, as with the Chechen warlord Kadyrov, where he is running rampant within Russia, shooting people, hiring an assassin for, you know, a couple of thousand dollars and giving them a target list and being done with it. No, this is a very sophisticated assassination that was supposed to succeed because they thought the Brits wouldn't figure it out. They thought that he would die. I mean, that's very clear from the report, that Litvinenko would die quickly, and the moment he died, the alpha rays would not be detectable. And they failed on two accounts. He didn't die quickly because it was a very weak solution that he ingested, and he was strong, and the pathologist, astonishingly, had done his PhD on polonium, despite the fact that there had never been a case of poisoning by polonium in UK history. This was his PhD subject. So it was quite astonishing coincidence that they caught it.
So there appears to be two kind of forms of assassination. As I mentioned, he's got Kadyrov and his sort of rogue KGB operation that appear to be behind, certainly, if not Nemtsov's recent assassination on the bridge near the Kremlin, certainly Anna Politkovskaya, it seems to be the case there. And of course, it seems like those are tributes, you know, as opposed to a direct order. It sort of reminds me of what Henry IV, will someone rid me of this troublesome priest? In the case of Anna, she was killed on Putin's birthday, which suggests to me maybe that was like a birthday gift. But in the case of this assassination in London, as you've made clear, it has to be authorized at the highest level simply to get your hands on this polonium. Right. Would that mean, though, that Putin is trying to get it the best of both worlds? On the one hand, he has some deniability. In this case, it backfired on him. But on the other hand, he's sending a strong signal to all those that might break ranks.
Well, there's no doubt that in Putin's world, there are, amongst the people he cares about, in other words, he doesn't care about the people per se, but he has his friends who are engaged with him in this massive corruption scheme, who he will not abandon. He's very loyal to them. He has his enemies who are political opponents, like Politkovskaya and Nemtsov. They're political opposition, they're enemies. But then there's a special category, and that's traitors. And if you are branded as a traitor, that's, you know, real KGB, FSB talk. For it is automatically assumed that there's a death warrant out for you because they never allow traitors to live. So the moment you're branded as a traitor, there you have to understand something is going to happen to you. And it's very clear, and this is detailed in the report, that Litvinenko lived in the shadow of having been branded a traitor for 6 years at least, because he broke with Putin in as early as 1998, when Putin was named the head of the FSB, and he went in to tell Putin that there's corruption in the FSB, they're going to kill, they have a list of political enemies, and they want to kill, and it became clear then that Putin knew about this and was, in fact, behind it, and he broke with Putin then. So, and went public with it. That was the sin, to go public with it. So there were many years there when he was in Russia and then fled from Russia and living in London, when he lived under the stigma of a traitor, being a traitor. And what's documented in the report is that this was not the first attempt to kill him. So it was simply the last and successful attempt. But he was living under the shadow of knowing that the KGB, FSB were going to come after him for breaking with the regime over its illegal activities, including its activities in the apartment bombings in Moscow and in other cities in Russia in fall of 1999, which was designed to act as a precursor to Putin's rise to power, as a kind of minister of war, the leader who could make Russians feel safe again. First, he made them feel unsafe, and then he made them feel safe. So,
right, that's the old trick of being both the arsonist and the fire brigade.
Yes, exactly.
So let's focus in then on the apartment bombings in the outskirts of Moscow in 1999. Putin, of course, used that as a pretext for his war in Chechnya, the Second Chechen War, where he vowed on television to flush them down the outhouse. Similar language as he's been using lately in regard to Syria, but obviously it resonated with the Russian people. That is the most, unbelievably cynical, the idea that you would kill a bunch of your fellow citizens in blowing up these apartment buildings in order to have the pretext to launch another war and to rile up the Russian public with vengeance. And, I mean, again, it's very hard to get your head around the idea that somebody could do that. But you mentioned that he doesn't care about the Russian people. He only cares about the Siloviki, his cronies that are a part of the sort of mafia state that he runs. That, of course, goes back to the kind of KGB mindset in itself, right? They're loyal to the state, but not the people.
Yeah, the Russians have this notion of the preeminence of the state, the idea of the state. There's really not a sense of in the popular psychology and political culture of Russia of citizens' rights. It's not possible to have rights against the state. The rights of the state would always preempt and supersede the rights of individuals. And bowing down in front of the state is a much longer tradition than periodic rebellions and uprisings in which people try to redress overreach by the state. I mean, there are such cases, but they are, 1917 was such a case, both the first and second revolutions, but Stalin then came to power and once again brought the preeminence of the state back into the way in which Russians are ruled. And Putin has very much the same mindset that the state is preeminent. And of course, he is the state. It's an astonishing moment in the thousand-year sweep of Russian history, that, you know, it's him and him alone, one person. This isn't czarism where you have a royal family with successors and rules and orders and privileges and all of that. No, there's one single person. And this is why people in Russia are talking about succession and how it's going to lead once again to the collapse, because there is no rule for how the country is going to be governed after Putin leaves one way or the other.
Right, but that plays into the whole thesis that in the British report into the assassination of Litvinenko, pointing the finger at Putin, because he is it. He's the Russian government. A lot of people are concerned that he spends all his time having to make thousands and thousands of decisions, and then he disappeared for a while, people wondering whether he's having more plastic surgery or whatever. They were quite concerned. So the fact that he does micromanage everything, and everything is funneled up to him, stovepiped all the way to him. He's the boss, right? They refer to him as the boss, don't they?
Right, absolutely. Or his closest circle refer to him as the czar.
Wow.
It's important to realize that it's physically impossible for him, even if he enjoyed putting in a full workday, which he doesn't, to in fact run everything. So clearly, when he micromanaged the takeover of Crimea, it's possible to have something occur which is well done. But he certainly was not micromanaging the Russian intervention in eastern Ukraine. He's certainly not micromanaging the Russian bombing of civilian targets in Syria. And he certainly is not micromanaging the Russian economy. Or the ruble to dollar ratio, which, as we speak today, is in free fall. So,
it's a
failure of that kind of system.
Sure. So, but as much as he doesn't maybe get the tactical things right and doesn't micromanage the details, strategically he seems to have gotten at least Crimea right, because by going into eastern Ukraine and causing all that trouble there, he's taken everybody's eye off the ball, and now basically everybody's accepted the annexation of Crimea. So strategically, it's worked out well for him.
Well, yeah. I mean, another way in which it's worked out well is that if we go back to the Litvinenko report, which is released today, logically, one would say, in absence of other events, that the British government should respond in the harshest terms by asking for the British and the Russian ambassador to Britain to be recalled. But I very much doubt that this will happen, because he has made himself indispensable in the solution of the Syrian problem. So by creating these problems, he's forced his way back onto the world stage. Again, I like your analogy. He sets the fire, and then he's in charge of the fire brigade to put out the problem, right?
Right.
This is exactly the way he's dealt with his exclusion from the G8. You know, you're not going to talk to me in peaceable times. How about I set the world on fire? Then you'll have no choice.
So,
that's a very dangerous moment that we're at. Very, very dangerous.
Well, clearly, in geopolitics, we've never had this phenomenon of the fusion of national security and organized crime, nuclear weapons, and the mafia. And I don't think we've ever been able to get our heads around that. And I guess just in closing, Karen DeWisher, I've often wondered why, you know, since he is a gangster and runs a gangster state, the one thing that gangsters crave is respectability, particularly when they sort of have achieved all of their goals, like in the case of The Godfather. That's fiction, but I think it's based on fact. So do you think that it's useful to deny him the respect that I think he craves?
Well, I mean, is it the alternative would be to sit down and treat him as an equal, as a legitimate leader, while he still is running a money laundering operation on a world historic scale, while he still is aware of the, as this report made clear, the Russian mafia was giving arms to Al-Qaeda. I mean, so, you know, he presents a multi-pronged challenge. It's not going to be enough to just treat him with respect. He, in a very significant way, he is undermining the very fundamental foundation of Western rule of law states. And that's something that we need to protect to the very end.
But can you then go, it doesn't look like you can go around him to the Russian people because they're in his thrall. 80% approve of him. At least that's what we hear from the polls.
Right. I think that if we have a bad winter, and God knows I'm not wishing this on anybody, much less long-suffering Russian people, a bad winter and a really continuing dire economic situation, they're going to see an increase in Russian dissatisfaction with the levels of corruption that will carry into the September Duma elections. Then we'll see. Can the ruling party hold, or will rival parties, even the within-system parties, like the communists, pick up a lot of votes because of their dissatisfaction with corruption at the regional level? Putin will be untouchable, but the polls also suggest that about 80% are very dissatisfied with high levels of corruption in their region. Will they turn up and vote or not? I think it'll be very interesting to see.
Well, Karen DeWisher, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, you're welcome. And nice to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Karen DeWisher, who's a professor of political science in the Department of Political Science at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, where she's the director of the university's Havergerst Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies. And her latest book is Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the diplomatic fallout from the report implicating Putin in the assassination. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Matthew Rajanski, who's the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. He's an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. And he's advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian region. And previously, he was deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rajanski.
Thanks very much, Ian. I'm happy to be with you.
And what do you make of the British inquiry? It's been going on for a long time into the poisoning and death of an exiled Russian intelligence officer in London. Now that they've finally come to a conclusion where they basically are saying that Vladimir Putin is likely to have signed off on the poisoning of Mr. Litvinenko with polonium-210, in part due to a personal antagonism between the two men. It has the Home Secretary, Theresa May, addressing Parliament today, saying the murder was a blatant and unacceptable breach of international law. On the Russian side, they're saying, well, we're not going to say anything, at least Peskov says this, we're not going to say anything, but we will act through diplomatic channels. So will there be any kind of thing beyond rhetoric here? This is the kind of situation where you normally recall your ambassador, isn't it?
Well, not necessarily. I think in many ways this has been a long time coming. It's been expected. The process obviously has been underway for years. His widow has been demanding this type of inquiry, and obviously the result was, you know, something of a foregone conclusion. After all, no one would have said 10 years ago when the actual assassination took place, no one would have said that there was any doubt that the trail led to the Kremlin. So not a lot of surprise. The question is really about context. You know, this is being presented in British politics as an indictment of a let's put it this way, of any softening in the Western line towards Russia around the Ukraine conflict, perhaps driven by Syria. So those who are looking for, you know, a ledge on which to stand in criticizing Cameron, in criticizing, you know, the broader apparent momentum towards seeking an accommodation with Russia on Syria, they now have it in the reminder of this affront and this indignity. And in fact, this, you know, they are characterizing it as a terror attack. So I think rhetoric is the key term here. And then I think, you know, one of the implications baked into the conclusion of the inquiry is probably accurate in saying that this could not have happened without Putin's approval, but nothing is being revealed in a sense that we didn't know before, because all of the evidence seems to be just the nature of the Russian system, that the way the system works, this has to have been ordered by Putin, approved by Putin, or at very high levels around Putin. I mean, none of that is at all surprising, and it's not stuff that wasn't on the table when this occurred 10 years ago.
So when the British Prime Minister David Cameron says that the UK will have to go on having, quote, some sort of relationship with the Russians because of Syria, he went on to say that we will do so with clear eyes and a very cold heart. I guess, in a way, Putin has made himself indispensable, has he not, in terms of the Syria situation, even though apparently at this point it's the Saudis who are screwing up apparently the peace deal, or at least the efforts to get to the table.
Well, look, if anyone had illusions over the last 2 years that there were not going to be consequences for Western interests of taking a tough line on Russia over Ukraine, then they have been roundly proven wrong, not only by Putin deciding to intervene in Syria in such a dramatic way and then to open himself, in fact, to dialogue and negotiation, which are really the only tools that we have available since we've played our sanctions hand, but just by reality, by the simple fact that, you know, you're dealing here with a country that President Obama has dismissively called a regional power, but that the Russian ambassador rightly responded and characterized as, yes, we are a regional power if you define the region as stretching from the Pacific to the Baltic and from the Arctic to the Middle East. So, in other words, this is not a country that you can simply sidestep. And now, does that mean, in Cameron's words, that you have to have you know, that you have to warmly embrace them? No, of course it doesn't. It means that you do exactly what he's proposing, that with cold, clear eyes and calculation, you engage where necessary on shared interests that can be reasonably advanced through some kind of limited cooperation, but that you make your disagreements very clear, and as needed, you impose consequences for undesirable bad behavior by the other side. It doesn't mean that you're going to succeed. It doesn't mean you're going to change the behavior. It's very unlikely you're going to change the nature of their system. In fact, you probably shouldn't even try, because that could be very counterproductive. And by the way, again, none of this is news. I don't think Cameron would have told you if you'd presented him with that quotation, you know, 2 years ago and said, what do you think of this as a policy? I think he'd have said, well, I think it's a pretty good policy. Look, Ian, several things are true here. Number one, it is old news. It's old news that nonetheless has political resonance and salience. Being resurrected makes it once again politically relevant, certainly in British politics, but, you know, the White House has also issued a statement about it. So it becomes a part of the overall context and background for the current strained relationship. That's one. Number two, look at the motives for doing this in the first place. This isn't just about personal antipathy. This wasn't just, look, there are plenty of people that Putin dislikes. that he doesn't kill. Why this guy was taken out has to do with the nature of the system. He was someone who was on the inside. He had privileged access through his KGB connections, but also the closeness that he had to individuals who were connected to potentially fraudulent enrichment schemes. And it was exactly those schemes, those very, very sensitive, very high-stakes games that he was helping the British and the Spanish authorities, as far as I understand, to investigate, possibly to expose and possibly to undo. And so the motive in taking this guy out, I think, was both preventive, prevent him from doing any more damage, and also symbolic, signal to everyone else who might be in such a position that there is no safe haven. You can go to one of the, you can go and you can collaborate. You can insinuate yourself in one of the wealthy, powerful, seemingly secure bastions of the West, even the security apparatus of the West, right? Cooperate with MI6, cooperate with the CIA. And as in the Cold War, you are signing your own death warrant and potentially that of your family. You will never be safe. And that message had to be sent to other Russians who are in those positions. And so the third point would be, as against both of those facts, the fact that this is old news, that it's already in the background of what's been going on, the relationship between Russia and the West, and second, that this was about signaling and messaging for a domestic Russian audience, there is no chance that the Russian government changes its position as a result of, you know, these allegations, which is really all they are from the Russian perspective, or even additional penalties that might seek to be imposed by Westerners. It's just not going to happen.
Well, I think what you've just told us, Matthew Rejansky, was exactly what happened. I was listening to the BBC World Service today, and the Kremlin TV spokesman on the state-owned television basically said, well, you know, this fellow, Litvinenko, was a member of our security services, and he was also a member of the British security services and the Spanish security services. And, you know, you can't be a member of all three services at once. It's not a very good idea.
That's exactly right. And I think part of the really deep anger in Russia, in elite circles, and in particular in the security apparatus at this guy, is the sense of betrayal, is that he came from a privileged group in Russia, which was, you know, with Putin, the security apparatus, the so-called siloviki, they inherited the earth in Russia. I mean, they had to watch pained in the 1990s as these petty crooks who were their sworn enemies, sometimes, you know, these political dissidents in the sense of liberally minded people, intellectuals, researchers from academies, gray market traders. These people all became the wealthy and the elite in the 1990s. And then Putin came in 2000. And with him, the law and order gang, right, the guys with either, you know, the so-called sword and shield of the KGB in their identity cards, or, you know, the epaulets on their shoulders in the form of the military, you know, they came in and they finally had their chance. And not only was it a kind of moral vindication, but it was, in many cases, great personal enrichment and personal privilege. And so the notion that this guy would betray and threaten his own on both of those levels is just, it's absolutely unacceptable. And by the way, I think it would be unacceptable in many other contexts as well.
So thus the use of polonium-210, Putin is getting it both ways. He doesn't have his fingerprints on it. I think they expected him to die much quicker and without fingerprints. But on the other hand, it does send a signal, does it not? The one that you're talking about, to other people within the security services that might be tempted to work with other services like the CIA and the MI6.
There's no ambiguity about the signal that it sends. I'm not sure that this attack did not go down exactly as it was planned. In other words, even in the Cold War, when the Soviets had far more opportunity and plenty more experience and obviously much more invested from the standpoint of politics and ideology and so forth in assassinating dissidents and enemies of various kinds, including turncoats who had gone to the West or who were in, you know, so-called neutral countries and so forth, plenty of attacks went down exactly like this. And so I'm actually not sure that attribution is not a part of the strategy. In other words, the message does not get sent quite as effectively if someone could reasonably believe that this person died of natural causes. They have to conclude that this was an assassination. And so the somewhat gory, as the British have said, even terror-like nature of this killing, you know, the fact that it was, you know, maybe not brutally violent, but it was sort of terrifying, and it was done in a very public way, that I think may have been entirely intentional. I don't think we can conclude that it was a mistake.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Matthew Rudzianski, given the nature of the Siloviki, that they're the sort of, you know, I don't think we've ever had this combination of national security and organized crime in geopolitics before, and they've replaced, you know, these are the new mafia, if you will. As you pointed out, they replaced the earlier iteration, and they're much more organized, and they've basically Putin runs the whole show to the point where there's virtually nobody else around. I don't know how much he has to micromanage anything. It's an amazing situation to have this vast country under the control of this one man with so much authority. But if he is to be seen as the boss of bosses, the guy that you don't cross, and if you do, you might end up being poisoned by polonium, what does he think about being called a gangster in the West? Does it bother him? A lot of gangsters, of course, want respectability.
Well, you ought to hear the things that Western leaders are called in the Russian press. I don't think name calling is in and of itself a particular issue. The lack of respect, though, the lack of mutual trust, and just sort of a human level of mutual respect between, for example, Putin and Obama or Putin and Cameron, that is a real problem, because even it compares unfavorably with the Cold War, where you may recall, you know, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan concluding that, hey, Gorbachev, this is a guy that we can do business with. Or even in the depths of the Cold War, certainly in the detente era, Nixon and Brezhnev sitting down, having, you know, genuine, productive, actually quite positive and pragmatic interactions, even though each of them was mutually dedicated on an ideological and political and even on a military level to the other's destruction. Kissinger is another example. So we saw this stuff all through the Cold War, and now we're not seeing it. Now we're seeing this just incredibly dysfunctional, aggressive dynamic between the two leaders. I think this sort of thing, actually attributing something to Putin that he is probably not particularly ashamed of, I think that holds almost no relevance in that context, because it doesn't change any of the fundamentals.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Matthew Rudzianski.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rudzianski, who is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. He's an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. And he's advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian regions. And previously, he was deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.